You have your Bible this morning, turn to Matthew chapter 7. I'll be reading two verses. Go ahead and read them. Verses 13 and 14. Matthew 7, 13. Enter ye in at the straight gate. Straight there, the unique spelling, the English word which means difficult, challenging. For wide is the gate, and broad is the way that leadeth to destruction, and many there be which go in thereat. Because straight is the gate, and narrow is the way which leadeth unto life, and few there be that find it. This begins, in all likelihood, Jesus' closing of the Sermon on the Mount. I don't know, some of you, I'm aware, I don't know how many watch the television series The Chosen, which has been on in the last few years. A Christian, contemporary Christian group tried to depict the life of Christ. Overall, they have done a better job than I have typically seen in productions of that type. There are times, Sandra and I have watched it up to this point. We got to the raising of Lazarus and the final episode in Jerusalem, and I thought, I don't know if I want to see all of that. We watched the Passion of the Christ and the brutality which they depicted against Jesus was just about more than I could handle. I don't know if I want to see a graphic depiction of that again. But anyway, in most cases, they track the New Testament record, but on occasion they deviate, and sometimes you kind of second guess and read into it. They're trying to make it interesting and appealing to the people who watch, and other times you just don't know. One of those, I don't know why they did that, they depicted Jesus preaching the Sermon on the Mount to the multitude. Let's reset. Go to the fifth chapter, verses 1 and 2. And seeing the multitudes, he went up into a mountain, and when he was set, his disciples, not the multitude, came unto him, and he opened his mouth and taught them, saying. Thus begins the Sermon on the Mount. The Sermon on the Mount is Jesus' message to disciples. It's not about going to heaven when you die. They're already saved. By definition, which we read in Acts chapter 1, one of those 12 men Jesus called was already a follower of John the Baptist and had been baptized by John. So these are saved people who need the words of Jesus to teach them what it means and how to live to honor God with their salvation. And so all of these things you read in Matthew 5, 6, and 7 describe the ideal lifestyle of a child of God. In the closing, beginning with this lesson, Jesus uses pairs, two things. There are two ways in these verses, the straight and the narrow way and the broad way and entrance. Then he talks about two trees, a good tree and a bad tree, false prophets, true prophets, less than perfect believers to those who are more conscientious. And finally, the closing lesson of the Sermon on the Mount, two foundations for a house. Jesus starts this lesson by enter ye in at the straight gate. In Luke chapter 13, verse 24, Luke's account is strive to enter in at the straight gate. This means to exert intense effort, intentionally, deliberately, and with great energy, labor to enter in. The gate, the opening into this way, is not easy street. It's not simple and straightforward. it's very difficult to get through the gate. And once you get through the gate, the way that you travel is narrow and continues to be difficult. It's not my faith and your faith and his faith, and we all have different faiths, and God's okay with that. There's one way, one faith, and it's not always easy. It's not always easy at all. It's interesting. You know me. I'm strong on the precision of biblical language, including the Lord's guiding men who translated our Bible into English. Enter ye in at the difficult gate. There are two ways in this lesson. There are two ways of life, two lifestyles that we face every day with every choice. You're faced with easy street, and on the other hand, a way that is demanding and challenging and difficult. What's our human nature? Oh, let's go the easy way. Therefore, we need to strive, exert effort to choose the right way. Solomon writes in the Proverbs, "There is a way that seemeth right unto man, but the end thereof, or the way, the ends thereof, are the ways of death." It looks easy. If it's easy, it must be right and good. Maybe not. Okay. Notice the language precisely. Enter ye in at the straight, difficult gate, for, because. Wide is the gate, and broad is the way that leadeth to destruction, and many there be which go in thereat. And then Jesus adds the emphasis in the beginning of verse 14, because straight is the gate. When you're faced with two options, and one is challenging and difficult and one is easy, choose the one that's right, even if it is demanding beyond your imagination. Few there be. Remember the setting. The Sermon on the Mount is to disciples, to children of God. Two Sundays ago, I preached from the Psalms. Teach me thy way, O Lord, and lead me in a plain path. Last Sunday, I continued that thought. This Sunday, we expand our thought. What is this straight way? Exactly what does it entail? I suggest that Matthew 5, 6, and 7 gives us full definition of the straight way. Now, let's be honest for a moment. Within the family of God, including when I look in the mirror, right? How many people do you know who make the lifestyle Jesus described in those three chapters their life choice? Not many. Not many at all. That's the point Jesus is making. How many churches today boast that we must be right because we have the large numbers? That doesn't fit with what Jesus says here, does it? Large numbers don't mean something. Choosing the way of Jesus is what counts. The two choices in Scripture are quite a common thing. I'm going to spend a few moments, so if you want to turn to Deuteronomy chapter 30, and I want to give you a lead up. In Deuteronomy 30, I want to begin with verse 11. This is Moses' farewell address to Israel before he dies on the mountain. "For this commandment which I command thee this day is not hidden from thee, neither is it far off." Now, at this point, Moses has given the people the tablets of stone, the Ten Commandments. He's given them the full explosion of Exodus and Leviticus, and now he's finishing off with Deuteronomy, his goodbye repeat of that law. But he's not referring to 10 principles of conduct written in two tablets of stone. He's referring to something much more intimate. It is not in heaven that thou should say, who shall go up for us to heaven and bring it unto us that we may hear it and do it? Neither is it beyond the sea that thou shouldest say, who shall go over the sea for us and bring it unto us that we may hear it and do it? But the word is very nigh unto thee, even in thy mouth and in thy heart, that thou mayest do it. Sometimes Christian people try to draw too much distinction between Old and New Testaments. Now, there's distinction to be drawn, granted, and they need to be respected. But when people say, well, people weren't born again in the Old Testament, that started when Jesus came. Well, then why did Jesus criticize Nicodemus? You're a master in Israel, and you don't know this? If it hadn't been an existing principle, Nicodemus wouldn't have been criticized, would he? Secondly, in the book of Romans, first in chapter 2, Paul describes two classes of people. One of those classes of people have the law of God written in their heart, and it has given them a sensitive moral compass, which they either listen to and it blesses, or they don't and it condemns. That's a saved person. At the end of chapter 2, he says they are. He's not a Jew which is one outwardly. He's a Jew which is one inwardly. And circumcision is that of the heart and not of the flesh, whose praise is not of man but of God. By the way, Paul quotes this lesson in Romans chapter 10. He's praying for a certain kind of Israel. Not every national or cultural Jew, but a certain kind of Jew, which he defined in chapter 2 as having the law written in their heart. And he's saying they're ignorant. Salvation is from death in sins, but there is a salvation in the gospel from ignorance. In Jeremiah, God said, I will give you pastors according to my heart who will feed you with knowledge and understanding. That's the purpose of the gospel. And Paul says, as a premise that is hard for Christians even today to grasp, Christ is the end of the law for righteousness to everyone that believeth. Moses and the law said, thou shalt not. That goes from 1500 BC all the way till Jesus came. Boom! When Jesus came, something changed. Christ ended the law for measuring and acknowledging and defining righteousness. For some folks, that's heresy. I'm quoting what Paul said. If you want to argue with Paul. And then he goes on to develop this premise in Romans 10 by saying that the righteousness, not the righteousness which is of the law, he gives us a new premise and a new principle of righteousness, the righteousness which is of faith, speaks this way and not this way. It is centered in a right belief and understanding of the death and resurrection of Jesus. And further, Paul writes that this righteousness, which is of faith, is not off somewhere else that we could say, go bring it to us. Huh? Does that sound familiar to Deuteronomy? But what saith it? The word is nigh thee, even in thy mouth and in thy heart. That is the word of faith which we preach. The gospel we're preaching to these people, Paul says, is already written in their heart. And that premise of the law of God written in the heart becomes the new measure of right and wrong for the child of God. The law written in the heart. It's not different from the Ten Commandments. It's just more intimate and personal. Now, this is the foundation. Let's develop the thought. See, who's Moses writing to? Israel, his farewell address to the nation. He's already defined the people to whom he writes as having this premise, which he is teaching them, this commandment written in their heart. Would you say they're saved or not saved? They're saved. They have the law of God written in their heart. Good. Now let's go from there. See, I have set before thee this day life and good and death and evil. Jewish writing often uses rhyming ideas or like ideas to further expand and teach us. Jewish poetry is not rhyming sounds at the end of lines, but rhyming ideas. Look at the pairs we find in this statement. I have set before thee this day life and good. We could say in our terminology, life, even good. And death, even evil. It's not going to hell when you die, and we'll see that expanded and emphasized as we go through the lesson. In that I command thee this day to love the Lord thy God, to walk in his ways, and to keep his commandments and his statutes and his judgments, that thou mayest live and multiply. Are you going to have kids and multiply in heaven? Don't think so. And the Lord thy God shall bless thee, _, in the land whither thou goest to possess it. This is temporal. This commandment which is written in your heart, if you follow it, God will bless you in the land that I have given you. But if thine heart turn away, so that thou wilt not hear, but shalt be drawn away and worship other gods and serve them, I denounce unto you this day that ye shall surely perish, and that ye shall not prolong your days upon this land, the land whither thou passest over Jordan to possess it. Second time, the emphasis, this is talking about either blessing and God's providence in ensuring that his people enjoy the land of milk and honey, or if they don't obey, God says you won't enjoy it and you won't stay in the land. Study their history. It speaks for itself. I call heaven and earth to record this day against you that I have set before you life and death, blessing and cursing. Therefore, choose life, that both thou and thy seed may live, that thou mayest love the Lord thy God, and that thou mayest obey his voice, and that thou mayest cleave unto him, for he is thy life and the length of thy days, that thou mayest, what? Dwell in the land which the Lord sware unto thy fathers, to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob, to give them. So, you've probably heard preachers preach this passage and do the altar call, and you're choosing heaven and going to heaven when you die. That's not what God's talking about. He's talking to his people about something they need to do today, right now, for the future of their life and their lifestyle. Same thing Jesus was teaching. Now, I want to put a little time frame. Moses wrote and lived around 1500 B.C., 1,500 years before Jesus came. We get much closer to the time Jesus came. This is, I picked this up from A.T. Robertson, his Word Pictures in the New Testament. And to that lesson in the Sermon on the Mount, Robertson refers to a Greek philosopher and a student and contemporary to Socrates. He lived from 430 to 350 B.C., so around 400 years, not 1,500, 400 years before Jesus. This is a quote from Sebes. Seest thou not then a little door? And a way before the door, which is not much crowded, but very few travel it. This is the way that leadeth unto true culture. A cultured Christian is a Christian who chooses the straight gate, the narrow way, and strives to live the Sermon on the Mount lifestyle. Well, we've defined in many ways what this is. Let's see if we can find some more light on this. John 14, you're very familiar, I'm sure. Verses 5 and 6. Jesus has just opened his final address the night of his betrayal to the disciples. And again, he's speaking only to disciples. And Jesus has told them in the first four verses that he's going to do something for them, and they can't go with him right now. They will later, but they can't now. Thomas saith unto him, Lord, we know not whither thou goest, and how can we know the way? You're telling us you're going, but where are you going? And if we don't know where you're going, how can we follow you when we don't know where you're going? Human reasoning, but not very good spiritual reasoning. Jesus saith unto him, I will show you the way. Why are you shaking your head? Really? What did Jesus say? I am the way, the truth, and the life. No man cometh unto the Father but by me. You go to the Father when you pray. You go to the Father when you read this book and meditate on it. You go to the Father when you speak an encouraging, kind word to a lonely pilgrim in Oregon. You're going to the Father with all of these things. And it's not a philosophy that drives you to do this. It's the person of the Lord Jesus Christ. There's a little bit of a sleeper I want to develop with you. Book of Acts, chapter 9. Later in this chapter, we'll find the description of Paul's Damascus Road experience. This is before. And Saul, yet deep in conviction, wrestling with what to do. You're shaking your head at me again. You folks are contrary this morning. Let's read what it says. And Saul, yet breathing out threatenings and slaughter against the disciples of the Lord, went unto the high priest, his superiors, and desired of him letters to Damascus, to the synagogues, that if he found any of this way, whether they were men or women, he might bind them and bring them unto Jerusalem. Six times in the book of Acts, Luke refers to or quotes people who use the term this or the way. The way. It would seem that at least before Acts chapter 11, and in some places after that, that the Christian faith was merely referred to as the way. Wonder where they got that idea. These people were standing up and teaching and preaching Jesus, and his life and his teachings, as in the Sermon on the Mount, as defining their faith. And then you get to Acts 11, 26. Barnabas is looking for Paul, and he finds him. And in verse 26, when he had found him, when Barnabas had found Paul, he brought him unto Antioch, and it came to pass that a whole year they assembled themselves with the church and taught much people. And the disciples were called Christians first in Antioch. So the initial identity of the church, of the disciples of Jesus in the first generation, was the way. Simply the way. And then as they began to teach and people understood more and more about what they represented, oh, these people are trying to follow Jesus. Yes! So they were finally called Christians in Antioch. Okay, let's go back to this Sermon on the Mount thing. Some of the things that Jesus teaches: murder. Oh, we can all accept killing someone is murder. Jesus redefines. Moses' law said, thou shalt not kill. That's good. Jesus says, if you're angry with your brother without a cause, you committed murder in your heart. And Jesus applied that in the heart, not out here, to principle after principle. You don't just guard what you do with your hands. You guard, Jesus says, what you do with your eyes, and you guard what you do with your heart. Ugh. Now, somebody says, well, if you don't believe that the Ten Commandments and Moses' law is the governing principle of morality, then you're going to be loose on morality. Read the Sermon on the Mount and tell me that's loose on morality. Jesus is more strict than Moses. In fact, he even says so. Unless your righteousness exceeds the righteousness of the scribes and the Pharisees, you shall not enter my kingdom. Checking the heart takes a whole lot more work than checking the hands and the feet. When was the last time you spent praying for your enemies? You know, that person that you absolutely despise. Come on, there are people in this world you do not like, right? Yeah. When's the last time you devoted prayer for them? When was the last time you forgave someone who had really stiffed you in some way? You just absolutely forgave them. You see, Jesus' teaching in the Sermon on the Mount is that forgiveness is not something that frees that person from the debt that they have committed against you. Forgiveness is something that frees you from the debt you have taken to be their judge. Let Jesus judge them. Let go of the burden of not forgiving and holding your anger against them. Let go and trust Jesus to chasten them if they're his child and to judge them if they're not. You go through action after action, and every time Jesus says, my in the heart, straight gate, narrow way is more demanding of you than Moses was. But it hits deeper and closer to home. You have to check it here. Well, somebody says, hey, preacher, I've read the Sermon on the Mount, and it's just impossible. I cannot do that. And since I can't do it, I'm just going to give up and not try. How about not giving up? How about we all say, yeah, I looked in the mirror, and if I go through three chapters and that sermon, no, I'm not measuring up. But Lord, give me grace to try harder. It's a hard way. It's a difficult task. It cuts against every fiber of my natural being. And maybe that's why, Lord, I need your grace to help me fight harder, to choose that way and to live that lifestyle. Yeah, it's demanding. But Jesus kind of made that point for us, didn't he? Yes, it's straight. It's hard. It's narrow. You can't stagger along casually going, yeah, okay, I'm going to be a Christian today. I'm not sure about tomorrow. You won't make the path by doing that, will you? It takes deliberate, conscious effort. That's what Jesus requires of us. He doesn't say, if you don't measure up, you know, okay, if this lesson is talking salvation, going to heaven when you die, and only the people who comply with the Sermon on the Mount all three chapters go to heaven, it's going to be an empty place. It's going to be an empty place. But if it applies like those words from Moses, which Paul brings to us in the New Testament, the righteousness of faith, which says Jesus is the object of my faith, and I pray to have a right knowledge and trust in Him, His death, and His resurrection. Lord, help me to start there as my anchor. And then you start listening and corroborating the righteousness which is of faith always agrees with this book. Always. None of this, the Lord gave me a vision and it's not in the scriptures. No, that righteousness of faith always agrees with this book. The same author wrote both books. So Lord, help us to strive. Yes, that's a Bible word, isn't it? To enter. See, think about it. These are 12 men who at the time Jesus is teaching them apart in the mountain have believed in him enough to forsake career. Have any of you forsaken a career because of Jesus? I mean, completely given up on a career and just follow him? But these people had. And yet, Jesus is telling those men who had forsaken a career, walked away from their boats, some of them perhaps from family, although they stayed in touch with family, I'm sure supported family in every way they could. There's biblical basis for that, by the way. But Jesus is saying to these men, enter the straight gate and the narrow path. Wait a minute. They've already made such a lifestyle change and they still need to enter? Okay, do a little study. Really anchor your mind in the teachings, the lifestyle Jesus taught in the Sermon on the Mount. And then go through the four Gospels and look at the lifestyle of those 12 men. All right, you can put one off to the side and trace the lifestyle of the 11. Did they measure up? Not at all. That's why Jesus said, strive to enter in, because always there's the easy, wide way that is so appealing. Keep striving. Keep working to enter and to walk. God bless.